The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, an Apple Premier partner. TechServe has been supporting New Yorkers for 29 years with Mac repairs and upgrades, including data recovery, liquid damage, hard drive issues, general troubleshooting, and more. TechServe.com. And An American in Paris, the new Tony Award-winning musical that brings the magic and romance of Paris into perfect harmony with the unforgettable songs of George and Ira Gershwin, winner of more awards than any other musical of the year. Tickets at AmericanInParisBroadway.com.
This is the Takeaway Podcast Weekend Edition. I'm John Hockenberry, and this is our chance to get a little long form with you here. We'll give you some of our favorite interviews from the past week and really lengthen them. We put in stuff that is illegal, actually, to play on public radio, but we like to, you know, keep stuff back and give it all to you now. Today, we're going to go across the pond. And you know, you would think that a people who misplace their empire, what an unfortunate series of events, and are stuck on a nasty little island that is just, you know, when you think about it, a cold, rainy paradise for sheep. You'd think that people in that situation might occasionally express a little humility. Nope, not the English.
The English are moral, the English are good, and clever and modest and misunderstood. The English are best. I wouldn't give tuppence for all the rest. It's not that you're wicked or naturally bad. It's knowing you're foreign that's driving you mad.
Ah, yes, the late duo Flanders and Swann merely expressing what every English person believes in their heart. Author Bill Bryson knows very well that you can't write such songs about his native Iowa. But after 40 years of living in the land of green hedges and dog's bollocks, he still finds the place a twisted mystery. His latest volume, called The Road to Little Dribbling, is a guidebook to all the odd places that appear on maps of the UK and constitute a grand geography of weirdness. With the English psyche as his compass, he tracked from one end of the UK to the other. He never made it to Little Dribbling, but there's a good reason for that. Bill Bryson, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Well, thank you. It's very, very nice to be back.
And let me just ask right at the top, Little Dribbling, The Road to Little Dribbling. Now, I suppose you must have encountered Little Dribbling on a map somewhere and you noted it down. Boy, I have to get to the bottom of that at some future time. Tell me the story.
Well, there isn't really a story. I was struggling for a title for the book. The book is a sequel to an earlier book called Notes from a Small Island.
Sure.
A title which made a kind of sense. And I thought, well, what am I – I didn't want to call it More Notes from a Small Island or anything as obvious as that. And so for quite a long time, this book was at least half written and had no title. And in a kind of desperation, I just started playing around with the road to this and that and – you know, the road to dementia and the road to, you know, permanent confusion. And for some reason, Little Dribbling both sounded somehow apt to the condition that I seemed to be advancing towards as I age, but also to it just seemed like a sort of quintessential English village name. So it's entirely made up, but it seemed to me appropriate that I should be searching for a place that doesn't really exist.
But yet it's completely plausible. I mean, you know, you're turning the page going, you know, when are we going to get to Little Dribbling? I mean,
well, that is the thing about British place names, is that there's almost no possible place name that doesn't sound fairly plausible.
And that is one of your pet peeves, or one of the things that annoy you is the kind of names that have made it onto the maps in the UK. Can you share a few more? Real ones this time?
Oh, gosh. Well, no, I mean, it's not a peeve at all. It's something that quite delights me. I mean, the British will live in places that I think you or I or anybody from America would be embarrassed to call home. And there's just so many of them. Great Snoring is one that we used to drive by when I lived in Norfolk. And I just thought, that's such a wonderful name. And you know, if you look into it, it'll be because it'll have some Viking origin. It will have meant something, you know, to do with farming or homesteads or something at one point. But you eventually come to the conclusion that the British live in places and keep these names simply because they like it. They like to live in a place that sounds faintly silly. I'm trying to think of other ones.
Also meaning. I mean, Nether Wallop, where does that come from?
Well, there's a whole cluster of villages called the Wallops. And Nether Wallop is just one of them. Why? What exactly Nether means in the context of it might mean upper or outermost, I suppose. But again, I would imagine is some sort of Saxon word, and rooted in it would be some very sensible meaning, original meaning. But I'm also absolutely certain that the reason the British hold on to that name is not because of any historical attaches, because they just like to say, I live in Nether Wallop.
I'd like to say, I live in Nether Wallop. I'm going to say it all day, I think. you know, what's great here is that you're describing a national trait of oddball creativity, in the sense that here in the United States, you know, they couldn't think of a name, so they came up with Cairo and then mispronounced it and called it Cairo in Illinois. I mean, you know, New York, excuse me, is that creative? I mean, New York is better than York, but still, we also have a York, Pennsylvania. I mean, how empty-minded and empty-souled are the Americans compared to these folks?
Well, I don't know about that, but I do know that when I was growing up in Iowa, I used to be kind of strangely enchanted with all the places. If you go drive across Iowa or any other state in the Midwest, you know, they're full of places like New London. And you think, did the people who settled here really think that they were going to build another London or New Glasgow or New Edinburgh or something? And you just think, were they really serious in thinking that this was going to be the new version of these great cities? There's something kind of endearing about that kind of ambition, but I think it was also perhaps just a touch misguided.
Well, also, there's the history of the United States. I mean, it's certainly the case that a lot of places in America, even though we don't refer to them that way, come from a very deep historical Native American origin, like Denali instead of Mount McKinley, named after a president. It's been changed back. And so you get the impression that the Americans are kind of quickly jotting down names, whereas in Britain, you know, it made it onto the map long after people were going, "Ah, it's the Nether Wallop, you know. It's not Wallop, it's Nether Wallop." I mean, so that makes sense, I suppose.
Well, it's a very strange thing, and I do think the names of places tell you a lot about a society and a culture. And you know, and one of the things that's interesting is whether people, when they found a nation like America or Australia, New Zealand or whatever, whether they keep the native names or whether they impose all brand new names. And I think we in the English-speaking world have been generally pretty good about listening to what the natives called the places and trying to preserve their names. I mean, obviously, very often we've corrupted them in some way. But you know, if you think about American state, and I say Illinois and Massachusetts and, you know, goodness knows what else. I mean, there's plenty that are based on original names rather than just, you know, calling them New England or you know, Nova Scotia or something. We very often have given them the native names. And I think there's something kind of dignified in that.
One of the things that I discovered in reading this book, and it's an impression that you get over time, even though you reference it a lot, is that, boy, outside of London, these towns are struggling economically. I mean, with a stiff upper lip, I suppose, but there's a certain dreariness to the, you know, all you can get in this town is coffee places that you visit.
Yeah, well, there is. I mean, this is something that I think is happening all over, but it's particularly visible here in Britain, which is that, you know, an awful lot of our retail life has moved online now. And where it hasn't, you know, when we're not ordering things online, we're shopping at malls more and more. The British, no less than people in America. And what that means is that, you know, Main Street, or the High Street, as they call it in England, is dying all over the place. And it's a really sad thing because, you know, so much of both America and Britain culturally are, so much is sort of attached. We have this deep abiding attachment to the idea of the small town, of the little town. And I find that a great sadness, well, both in America where I come from and in Britain where I now live, that these little towns are struggling to keep shops going, that people, you know, just don't buy things at their local shops anymore. And I wish it was otherwise. It's something that I lament a great deal in the book. But I have to say, I've lamented it in books I've done about America too.
Does Google and the online world make it easier to pass that, shall I say, bloody test for citizenship that you took?
Well, nothing makes it very easy to pass the British citizenship test because it's just such, it's like so much of Britain, it's just a kind of wildly idiosyncratic test. The I mean, I go on about it at some length in the book because it was a bit of an obsession with mine at the time I was writing the book. I was studying for the citizenship test. The two things you have to establish when you take citizenship, apply for citizenship in Britain, one is that you are an accomplished speaker of English, and if you come from an English-speaking nation, you are spared having to take the test, as I was. But the other part is that you have to show that you're familiar with British life enough to pass a quite challenging multiple-choice test. And a lot of the questions on the test are things that nobody would know. I mean, not even, you know, many British academics would be able to answer them. The one that that particularly sticks in my mind is you have to be able to say who a figure named Sake Din Mohammed was. And the answer is that he's the person who introduced shampoo into Britain sometime in the 18th century.
Oh, my goodness. I mean,
and part of the reason, I mean, reading between the lines on these, part of the reason is that they want you to appreciate that Britain is a multicultural society. So they've thrown in questions on things that most people don't know about, but that touch on immigrants from the distant past as a way of establishing and reminding the test taker that Britain has had people coming into it for a very long time. So there's a certain merit in those questions, but also you have to study very hard in order to pass them because they're mostly asking you about things that nobody knows.
So the odd Pakistani with a British passport doesn't have any idea where shampoo came from.
Well, yes, and lots of other things. I mean, you have to, in order to pass the test, you're expected to know quite a lot about, I did a fairly obscure Welsh poets, for instance, or you're expected to know things like exactly how many members of Parliament there are. Well, I mean, I doubt really if even every member of Parliament could tell you how many members of Parliament there are exactly. And so there's an awful lot of very specific questions that are asked of you. I learned a huge amount about the country in order to pass the test, but then I have to say I forgot almost all of it as soon as I had passed the test.
Well, all stuff worth knowing, but nothing like the American test, which is just the odd bit of really patriotic kinds of historical details that almost everyone would know.
Yeah, well, I thought about it hard about it. I mean, what would you put on a test if you're really trying to make sure that a person is qualified to be a citizen of your country? You know, what kind of things do they really need to know? And if you think about it, I mean, it would be a lot more to do with questions of diet and culture. And, you know, in an American test, they should have to explain what a squeeze play is in baseball, or, you know, what's the difference between a kickoff and a field goal in football or something like that. Then you'd know that they're really, you know, they're really ready to live there. But instead, they tend to load these questionnaires with lots of historical trivia, really.
Now, in America, we're obsessed with Downton Abbey, which did a reasonably good run there in the UK. But it might give us the impression that service is really great at commercial establishments when, in fact, you discovered quite the opposite.
Well, service has never been the British strong suit. I'm not entirely clear why that is, but it's just particularly I do ventilate a little bit about it in the book, where particularly when you go in a shop and you're the only customer, they don't greet you terribly warmly. In fact, you get the distinct impression that they'd really wish that you would just go back out the door again and not sort of come in. Certainly don't come in and start touching any of the sweaters or anything, because that means they have to refold them. And there is this kind of instinct to treat you you know, as if you're some sort of intruder. You still will occasionally find signs in British shop windows that tell you as you come in the door, no obligation to buy, as if it's something you have to be told, that you don't have an obligation to buy. It's a really strange attitude. I don't know quite where it comes from. I do compare it with the American system, which is where, you know, very often I find in America I feel as if I'm being rather suffocated by the sales. The tension can be so so intense and personal, particularly if the sales clerk is kind of underemployed. I've been in lots of department stores where I was the only person in the menswear section at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and you will often get someone who will follow you all the way around and you know, kind of point out to you the most obvious things, like these are our shirts here and our belts are over here. So as I say in the book, I'm never quite sure which is the more irritating to me, being pestered half to death by some well-meaning but slightly bored salesperson, or being treated as if I'm a great intruder. Neither one makes me very happy. So basically what I do is I don't shop if I can help it.
But retail is one thing. I mean, the pubs are quite another. Again, you have this myth that it's all warm and fuzzy inside the British pub and that everyone's, singing Irish and British folk songs.
Well, it can be. I mean, pubs are still, when you can find a good pub, the pubs are still, just the best places in the world. They especially if you're a stranger in a community. I talk in one part of my book, I just pitched up in a little Welsh coastal village called Fishguard, and I just, I had nothing to do in the evening, so I tend to go to the pubs quite a lot in the evening. And I went in there, and it was a tiny pub, a very small pub, so small enough that you were, whether you wanted to or not, you were actually part of the conversation. I mean, you were really physically with everybody else in there. And I had a most delightful time and met people. British are quite shy. They will usually leave you alone if you act as if you wish to be left alone. But if you show any signs of friendliness, generally they will respond in kind. And that's exactly what happened in this particular pub. So that does happen a lot. But at other times, there's another occasion when I went to a different pub and I just tried to make some pleasant conversation with the man, and he kind of bit my head off. And I found that very strange too. So I suppose it's like anything. You get good and bad of any kind of thing.
Lunch on Sunday afternoon can be a little trouble, though.
What's your thinking?
Your experience at the Swan. In a place called New Forest. Really blew it there.
Yeah, we went to, this is a pub in the New Forest, which is, I have to say, a lovely part of the country. And we went in, and it looked, just absolutely looked like a terrific pub from the outside. But we went in, and it was just a strange place. I had this happen to me a couple of times on my trip around the country, where we went in and nothing much happening, and I tried to order food. I was with some friends, we were walking, and we tried to order some food, and they said, no, they weren't taking food orders just now because the chef was run off his feet. And we looked around and there was hardly anybody in the pub. I mean, and I just said to the man, it's a Sunday afternoon, it's tourist season. Did you not expect people to be coming in around lunchtime, maybe wanting some lunch? And he said, yeah, exactly. He said, that's why the chef is so busy. And I just said, well, you maybe plan this a little bit better, because probably lunchtime on a Sunday is one of the best times to do meals in the British week. So I guess what I'm saying is that I have known Britain for well over 40 years now, and although I'm still happily resident here, in many ways it still feels like a foreign country to me.
Hmm. Is your impulse to go to the UK quite some time ago something to do with finding the most exotic place that still you could function in because you know the language?
Well, it was very easy to move here because of the language. But now what happened with me was, we're looking at the early 1970s. I was 20 years old, and in those days, every young person was going off to Europe every summer and backpacking around Europe. And I really intensely wanted to do that. I mean, I'd grown up, spent the first 20 years of my life in Iowa, in the very middle of America, and I felt as if all of anything that was globally exciting was not in Iowa. It was everywhere else. And so I just wanted to go to Europe and see the bright lights and experience all of that. And I went over. I spent 4 months hitchhiking around. I had the most wonderful time. I found that it was something I really loved doing, just moving around and traveling from place to place, particularly being in foreign environments. I found I really loved it. And at the end of the summer, entirely by chance, I stumbled into a job in a psychiatric hospital just outside London. And I took this job, intended to stay for just a few months. And during the time I was there, I met a student nurse who subsequently became, and I'm pleased to say, still is my wife. So by meeting an English girl and marrying an English girl, I kind of married into the country and found that, so I found myself falling for her and falling for England simultaneously. And that was more than 40 years ago. Hmm. And I'm still with them both. So I am very, very happy here. You know, I hate to give the impression that England completely drives me crazy. As with any culture, any society, there are things about it that I find challenging. But by and large, I think it's still, it is a really wonderful country. And part of what makes it wonderful is that it is so bewilderingly eccentric. It can be incredibly exasperating, but most of those things, I would hate it if they were, if they were somehow removed. I would hate for all that eccentricity to be taken away.
Well, it sounds as though your beginning in a psychiatric hospital gives you a certain natural vigilance about those eccentricities that you've kept with you all this time.
Yeah, well, it has to be said. I mean, genuinely, it has to be said that Britain is probably the best place in the world. A psychiatric hospital is probably the best place in Britain to get to know the country because
in a good way, in a good way,
because the patients at this hospital, I mean, it was a really, really delightful institution insofar as a psychiatric hospital can be called delightful, but the patients were mostly long term and they were really mostly quite sweet, and they were there because they just needed to be looked after, but there were a lot of people who were deluded, who thought they were some other person, who the kind of people who thought they were Napoleon or that sort of thing, and mostly mostly they were harmless and very, very eccentric and really quite nice to know, and I can honestly tell you that very often, if apart from the uniforms, you couldn't tell which were the patients and which were the staff.
There are some details in here that are really sobering. For instance, the history of the town of Grimsby, a port city, which in 1950 had one level of production and today has quite another level of production.
Yeah. Grimsby is a really sad place. And I mean, a salutary lesson about, the seas are not inexhaustible. As a species, we are the most foolish organisms that we think, we human beings think that we can just keep taking and taking and taking food out of the sea and that it'll go on sustaining itself forever. And Grimsby is living proof that that doesn't work, because I can't remember offhand the figures I used, but I mean, in the 1950s, up through the 1950s, Grimsby was landing, tens of thousands of tons of cod and ling and haddock and herring and all kind, and just name an edible fish. They were landing it in tens of thousands of tons, and now the figures are just 20 tons or 15 tons or virtually nothing. The industry hasn't just collapsed; it's virtually vanished. At one time, Grimsby was not just the biggest fishing port in Britain; it was the biggest fishing port in the world. And now, 30 years later, it doesn't exist at all, effectively as a fishing port. And so the overall atmosphere of the place is a great loss of a place that's really quite depressed and frankly depressing. And that's sad and completely unnecessary. If human beings had managed things better, we would still be, making a livelihood from the North Sea, instead of, just keeping our fingers crossed and hoping that by not fishing at all now, we'll somehow the stocks will eventually recover. And of course, this is an experience that has been repeated just as much of the Grand Banks of North America and lots of other places. So, yeah, it's a really, really unnerving example of how foolish we can be as humans can be.
Do you think the British have a deeper understanding of this change that can take place with industrialization and mass-scale development? For instance, you quote this oceanographer, this York University oceanographer, who talks about how when 211 people have a dinner of mahi-mahi, 488 turtles, 455 stingrays, 460 sharks, and dozens and scores of other fish are killed, just thrown overboard dead, just to get these mahi-mahi, and that's perfectly legal.
It's perfectly legal. It's what's termed the bycatch. And these are fish, mahi-mahi, that are caught with what are considered enlightened nets, tuna dolphin-friendly nets, I think they call them, that supposedly allow most fish to escape, the most fish that you don't want to escape. But what happens is that, you know, even when the nets are as kind of as well designed as possible not to cause a lot of unnecessary death to sea creatures, there's still lots and lots that get tangled up in it. And what he gives in his book, and I repeat in mine because it's just so arresting, is the volume of bycatch that were necessary in order to produce I can't remember the exact number, you just said 240 or something mahi-mahi. It's, you know, it's just shocking. It really is shocking. And, I mean, speaking for myself, I will never order mahi-mahi again after having read this book, because it's just, you know, you are killing lots and lots of other innocent creatures in order to have one plate of mahi-mahi.
Well, it'll end the conversation if they're eating fish and chips there in the pub. I want to end on a lighter note here, and this is one that was a mind blower to me. I mean, you know, I've spent a lot of time in the UK. I certainly don't know the details as you know them, but your chapter on the resort town in Lincolnshire of Skegness.
Yeah, Skegness, yes.
Skegness, that's how you pronounce it? I mean,
yes.
The idea that hundreds of thousands per year and perhaps millions over decades would go to such a place for a vacation and the kinds of activities, it was just unbelievable. I was hysterical reading every sentence. What is it? It's so well known in Britain, and yet I've never heard of it.
Yeah, well, that's just, and I had never been there. I mean, we're talking about a country I've, you know, been around, lived in for most of the last 40 years, and I'd never gotten to Skegness. So I thought, when I was doing this book, I thought, it really is time I went and had a look at it. And it's one of, I mean, it's by no means the most popular seaside resort in England, but it's one of the ones, it's one of the old established kind of traditional seaside resorts. And all the seaside resorts in my lifetime, in the last generation or so, have really started to struggle because, first of all, the British climate is not, as you'll be aware, it's not very conducive to beach holidays.
It's not Cancun.
It's not Cancun. And what's happened, you know, since the 1970s is that all of these cheap flights to the Mediterranean have come along, and package holidays have just, you know, siphoned off all their business. So these poor seaside resorts all over Britain and indeed all over the north of Europe are really struggling to reinvent themselves. And some have amazingly done it as kind of short-term places where you would go to have maybe a long weekend, but a kind of foodie-based weekend and things like that. But most of them, like Skegness, are really, really struggling. So it's hard not to feel sorry for them. But at the same time, you do wonder, what the people who are still going here, why are they coming here? Because, well, you know, for an equal amount of money, they could go to the Mediterranean and bask in very warm sunshine.
It's a little like the story of the Catskill. It's a little like the story of the Catskills in the United States, but it's so, so different. It's sketch out for me a typical day in the life of a Skegness holiday maker, as they would say.
Well, you would go and stay in a fairly small hotel or guest house in probably clean but fairly Spartan accommodation, and then, you know, you would have that breakfast would normally be included, so you'd start your day with breakfast, a hearty English breakfast. Then you would go out and spend the whole day hoping that the rain will stop. But knowing in your heart of hearts that that's unlikely to happen. And so most of your time would be spent shuffling around, trying to sit on the beach if there is no rain, if the rain actually relents for a little while. But if it is raining, and very often it just rains and rains and rains for days on end, you end up, you know, kind of mooching around in the shops or going to penny arcades and things like that. It is, if you're from any other part of the world, it is a real mystery what people are doing. But I mean, I make a joke in the book about the first time I went to the British seaside in sunshine. I saw all these people frolicking in the water, and I sort of took off my T-shirt and raced into the water and dove in. And I say in the book, it was like diving into liquid nitrogen. I have never been so instantly cold in my whole life. There is never a time when any sensible person would want to enter the waters around the British Isles. They're freezing. They're perishing. And yet, you know, hundreds of thousands of people still go there and still frolic and still seem to be enjoying themselves. Although, as I suggest in the book, all their shrieks are not from joy, but probably from agony.
Well, and some from other ways of getting warm that you discover in a bit of an investigative journalist part of these holiday camps. Organized sexual activity between the staff and the guests?
Oh, well, this is it was. I mean, but when you say organized, it makes it sound as if it were, you know, part of contractual or something. No, but this was Skegness is famous because it was the seat of the first big holiday resort, holiday camp, a place called Butlins. These are barely hanging in there now, but at one time they were huge, and they were really like. Well, they were like, if you think of children's camps, but for adults, children's camps in America, but for adults, that's kind of what they were. They were places where people could go and have a cheap holiday, very, very basic in terms of the amenities, but you know, okay, comfortable enough. But what they really became was places where, this was in the 50s and 60s, where young, unattached, you know, groups of young unattached boys and groups of young unattached young women could meet up and frolic. I'm kind of struggling for the right term there, but you know what I mean.
We know what you
mean.
Yeah.
And but also then a lot of the people who worked there were also young and unattached, and so there was apparently, according to a respectable history of the holiday camp movement, there was quite a lot of a to-ing and fro-ing. Again, I'm struggling for terms.
A point system? You're sounding very British there, Bill. a point system for nabbing?
At least one camp was famous for having a point system where if you were on the staff, having different kinds of conquests, you got different kinds of points. And starting at the top with the manager's partner, wife or partner, that was kind of the maximum number of points you could get on.
Well,
down
of course,
to,
yeah.
But anyway, you can imagine. You don't need me to specify, I'm sure. But apparently that's the way it used to be. I think those days are pretty well gone now.
Have you put your writerly footprints in every part of Britain down now? Did you go away from this project feeling as though no stone is left unturned and that you've demystified the place completely?
No, that is the most amazing thing about Britain because, you know, it's physically, it's not very big. You know, Britain is about the size of Iowa and Minnesota put together. I mean, that's the whole of it, Wales, Scotland, England, all of it. So that doesn't physically take up a whole lot of space, but it is just infinite. I mean, there's so many places and there's so much history and people have been doing productive and imaginative and creative things in that small space for so long, for so many millennia, that there's hardly, you know, a corner of it that isn't in some way fascinating and worth looking into. And what I found was as soon as I finished the book, turned it into the publisher, I kept living here, but I also kept moving around in Britain. And I'd find, you know, come to town, I think, I wish I'd, you know, I didn't get this in the book. I wish I had. You know, I wish I'd known about this place 6 weeks ago because I could have got it in the book. And I'm still having that experience. You know, it's been some months now since I finished the book. And almost every time I leave the house, I find something new that I hadn't known before. And I'm presuming that that's going to be however many years on earth are left to me. I will keep having that experience over and over again.
Well, I suspect they will be suitable chronicles for yet another book about Britain. This one was terrific. Bill Bryson, thank you so much.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Bill Bryson's latest book that he's been talking about here on The Weekender is The Road to Little Dribbling. And that is your Weekender for this weekend. You can now go about your business, doing drywall in the garage or the attic or whatever it is you do on your weekend. I'm sure it's very productive. We like to be with you in that productivity. Join us every weekend by subscribing to the Takeaway Podcast, which you can do by going to thetakeaway.org. Have a great weekend.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.